So as we're all aware from what we've learned in the past, there are countless junctures at which we find intersections and convergence and sometimes confrontation between various fields of science and Torah, and in particular in the words of Chazal. So we could really devote more than just one or two shiurim, but probably a whole course devoted to analyzing and studying this one aspect of Torah and the theoretical and the practical realms as well. But I want to try to zero in for tonight on a handful of subtopics within this realm, and perhaps, depending on what we cover tonight, maybe if there's interest in future weeks, certainly next week, we can try to devote it to other areas within this subject. So I want to discuss these issues beginning now, because a number of them actually emerge from this week's Parsha, Parshas Noach, within the scope of what we'll discuss. So it's really a natural opportunity to bring it up now. The topic, I put fossils at the beginning, and it definitely puts us into the discussion a little bit in terms of the questions of archaeology and Judaism, where we find things that that confirm or seem to support one another, and where the opposite is true. And when we talk about fossils, talking about dinosaurs, so that's really paleontology. But again, archaeology is not what I want to discuss this week, maybe next week instead. But just one thing which really is directly relevant to Parshas Noach, which I'll throw out there, if anyone has come across the book, it's called History of the World in Six Glasses. It's written by Tom Standage, and it was a New York Times bestseller in 2005. And he basically goes through the history of various beverages and how they fit into world history. And in his chapter on wine, he actually makes reference to this week's Parsha, where he tells us that archaeological evidence, just going to read you from the beginning of chapter 2, archaeological evidence suggests that wine was first produced during the Neolithic period between 9000 and 4000 BCE. And the Zagros Mountains in the region that roughly corresponds to modern Armenia and northern Iran. So the earliest physical evidence for wine found in the world in the form of a reddish residue inside a pottery jar comes from a Neolithic village in the Zagros Mountains, dated to about 5400 BCE, and he writes at the end of the paragraph, wine's probable origin in this region is reflected in the biblical story of Noah, who was said to have planted the first vineyard on the slopes of nearby Mount Ararat after being delivered from the flood. And that's the pasuk we find in Parak Tes, pasuk Chof Aleph, that shortly after Noah exited the Teva, he and all of his family, the first thing he did was become a farmer, and he planted a vineyard, and he became drunk, and that's the story that ensues at the end of this week's parsha. It's just interesting that archaeologists have traced the origins of wine to about the same time at which Noah really introduced into the world, because it's kind of funny when you see pictures, people portray what it looked like when Noah exited the Teva. So obviously you have the rainbow, and you have, you know, all the animals streaming out in pairs from the Teva, looking out on a beautiful green landscape with trees and plants and everything. And it really didn't look like that. It was pretty empty and desolate, because it wasn't only the people who were destroyed in the Mabul, but it was anything that was growing on the ground also was destroyed. So it really was Noah's planting of the Kerem that brought it back, brought any vegetation back into the world. Okay, so let's stick more to the point. What I want to focus on is really the flood part of the title, because the Mabul was not only a cataclysmic event in the sense that all life on earth was destroyed, but also for a different reason. Nature itself was altered greatly in some very significant ways, and it's actually hinted at by some of the Mefarshim, and the Pesukim we'll read on Shabbos, and that'll be a good starting point for the primary subject this evening. Let's take a look at the first source. Is not actually numbered, but the Pesukim describing right after the flood. So Noah and all of his family came out. All the animals followed as well. Pasachof, Noah builds a mizbeach and brings karbonos on the mizbeach. Pasachof Aleph. HaKadosh Baruch was pleased by the karbanos that Noach brought, and he says to himself, as it were, I'm never going to curse the world again. Despite the evil of man, I will not destroy the world and all living beings in the same way that I did. And here's the punchline. Od kol yimei ha'aretz zera v'katzir, v'kor v'chom v'kayitz v'chorev v'yom v'layla lo yishbosu. Simply translated, for the rest of the existence of the earth, Zerah v'katzer, planting and harvesting, kor v'chom, cold and warmth, kaitz v'chorev, summer and winter, yom v'layla, day and night, lo yishbosu, from the word Shabbos, to rest, will not rest. And so what exactly does that mean? Torah lists all these different phenomenons, different seasons, they will not rest. What does that mean? So the Sfarno, we'll start with Rav Hirsch in number two. We'll go back to the Sfarno in a moment. Od kol yimei ha'aretz, mefarshim b'derach klal kach. So first Rav Hirsch brings the generally oft-quoted interpretation of this pasuk. Onos hashana v'hayimama, the seasons of the year, and the daily elements of the changes of hours of the day. Lo nogu kisishim b'mei ha'mabul. Time did not function in the same way that it does now during the days during which the mabul occurred. Mishum kach nitnakan havtacha, and therefore there's a promise given here. Lo ye'od mabul sheni, lo yochol shinu b'mahal ha'rogil shol ha'onos. Even though the celestial bodies, the sun, the moon, the stars, were not functioning the way they normally would be, and as that really was the cause, we're told, as to why there were not any normal seasons, and the sun didn't rise and set the way we experienced that, because they stopped working. So the promise of HaKadosh Baruch Hu was not just not to bring a mabul, but also not to cease the functioning of the celestial bodies, which ultimately contribute to the way that our seasons and the difference in temperature and weather as they occur. Ulam, HaMesoros HaMekubalos B'yadeinu Misnagedes L'Anachazu. The verse says, our Mesorah, the tradition from Chazal, actually is different from this interpretation. The way in which agriculture worked before the Mabul was that once in 40 years, that's all it was necessary. That's all that was necessary. You plant once in 40 years, and then you got all the crops that that you needed for the next 40 years. Hayaviv Tamid, it was constantly springtime, beautiful weather. And it was a very consistent a pattern throughout all the seasons. Hayalahem Avir Yafek Mina Pesach Aratzeres. The Medrash tells us that it was always that beautiful springtime weather, as we find in March, April, May. Mezek Avir Hayashav B'chol Aretz, the entire globe experienced the same type of beautiful weather. V'hayabash Elohaisim Mefutzelas. Also, the landmass was not broken up by different natural bodies of water, etc., which also, you know, geological theory assumes that there was a period in time when there was something called Pangaea, which is one supercontinent, where all the seven continents that we have now were actually one. So he says, look in the next line, Kach haisa tachbur mehir misofa olam ad sofa. Transportation was very quick from one end of the world to another. Hayimahalcha misofa olam ad sofa l'sha kala. The Medrash tells us, in quotations, that you could pretty quickly go from one end of the world to the other. So he says the pshat in that is because there weren't different continents. All of the entire landmass was together, was one. Chayin muchach sham beferish, onos hashana niskaros kan niskanu rak achar amabul. The different parts of the year, Zerah v'katzer, the time of year which we plant, the time when we harvest, kor v'chom, cold and warm, etc., were only established after the mabul took place. So therefore, if you go back to the Sfarno, Sfarno reads this beautifully into the pasuk. Lo yishbosu will not stop. Right, these different onos, these different times of year will not cease to function as they do now. Not like the original pshat that the Rav Hirsch brought, that we'll never have an interruption in the functioning of the celestial bodies, but rather, lo yishbosu min lahasmin al oso ofen bilti tivi shegbalti lahem achar mabul. The current state, the state after the mabul, in which the seasons are not equivalent, but rather there's a warm time of year, there's a cold time of year, etc., kor v'chom kayutz v'choref, that will remain constant from now on. Why? He says, what was different about the way the sun traveled pre-Mabul? Before the Mabul took place, the sun went directly overhead from east to west, whereas if you look at the sun now, depending on the time of year, it's not going to go directly overhead and even in a straight line, but it's going to go a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right, depending on what time of year it happens to be. And that ultimately is what determines the seasons, because it really has to do with the angle at which we are facing, based on the fact that the Earth has an axis approximately 23 degrees. And that axis of 23 degrees, that tilt did not exist before the Mabul, and as a result, the sun always hit the Earth uniformly across the globe. So that's where the changes took place, and just read another line or two, otherwise reflects similar to what Rav Hirsch told us. The life was much easier. There was a much greater quality of life for all living creatures and plants because it was always a beautiful springtime. Now, if you skip back to Rav Hirsch in source number two, the second paragraph, he continues along these lines. We find, if you look in the Pesukim, the people who lived before the Mabul lived extremely long lives, going up to close to 1,000 years. And he says one of the reasons that contributed to that was the beautiful climate and a wonderful environment that they lived in. Now, after the Mabul, when the seasons do affect people, different times of year, different temperatures, etc., so people get sick, people don't have the same longevity.
How about Adam's question last explosion?
Yes.
It sounds like he was plunged into a hostile.
Right. So he had to work for his to eat, but once in 40 years, right? So that's pretty good. If I only had to go to work once every 40 years, I'd be in good shape. Yes, okay. But if you could spend your entire life in retirement, you wouldn't complain either. But you have to remember, so if he was, he died at 930. So once every 40 years, it adds up. Okay. There were different climates. He says this difference in the way the world functioned before and after the Mabul is reflected through various scientific discoveries. He said the research leads us to the conclusion that the current environment that we live in only came at a much more, relatively recent era, and also the way that the continents are broken up also came in a much later era. Okay, without belaboring this point, I'm just going to mention one more similar notion in the Malbim in source number three, the next column. Od Shinoi Gimel, this is the second paragraph. Od Shinoi Gimel Sheyom V'Layla Lo Yishbosu. Okay, this gets back to your point. There's a third change. He makes reference to the Svarno and Rav Hirsch, difference in climate, difference in the way the seasons function, and difference in the axis of the earth. A third difference, Yom V'Layla Lo Yishbosu, so the end of the puzzle, what does it mean that day and night will cease to function, right? So if we're moving off of the original understanding that Rav Hirsch cited, so day and night will fit into the fact that the sun didn't rise and didn't set the way it does now, which, by the way, is just an interesting question. The Pesukim describe Noah waiting 7 days between sending out the Ari, and then sending out the Yonah. So how did he know what was the day, what was the next day, if the sun wasn't rising and setting, and the earth wasn't, it seems, revolving in the way it normally does? Either way, that's how you'd explain, according to that understanding, Yom V'Layla Yishbosu. Sha'ariz lo sitein piryo seha b'nakel kmo kodem ha-mabul. He says a new pshat. What does it mean, day and night will not rest? It means day and night lo yishbosu, you, human beings, will not rest, because the world will not produce fruit in the same way as easily as it did before. They will not be able to rest from work. Etc. So it really is getting back to the point that yes, whatever the curse of Adam was, it still wasn't too bad. But after Noah and the Mabul came along, so that's when it really hit hard. Okay, so that's how we examine the Pesukim and how it emerges from the text, the notion that there was a major change in the physical nature of the world we live in pre-flood, pre-Mabul, and after the Mabul. Just throw one or two more examples. The Medrash tells us that Noah was the first human being born since Adam HaRishon without webbed hands. Okay, embryologically, scientists point out that a child, a fetus, at a very, very early stage, still has some webbing between the fingers. Ultimately, that ceases to develop and disappears. But it's beautiful when you look at the pasuk in Perek Hey, pasuk Chav Tes, Vayikra Shmo Noach. Noah is born, and his name is Noah. Lemor is Zeyinachaminu Mimaseinu Mitzvon Yodenu Min Adama Asher Era Hashem. Somehow they knew, prophetically or otherwise, that Noah, his birth marked a new tekufa, a new era in which life, tilling the soil, working the land would be a lot more simple. So now, the Midrash and Rashi talks about a little bit say that during Noach's lifetime, so the plow was put into use. But another pshat, based on this medrash, is that no, he actually had hands that were much more functional in manual labor, and that's why he was known as Noach. That's what it means, because he really had the physical qualities, unlike those who came before him. The last thing, which will again move us a little bit closer to a question of natural change in halacha, is the extensive discussion of the what happened to the dinosaurs, where did they come from? Amongst the classic mafarshim, just to mention the two primary approaches. One I have in the English quotation. I'm sorry, it's not the best scan, but the Tveri Sestro was of the opinion that although some, he's writing in the 19th century, although many at the time were using the fossils that were unearthed to serve as a challenge to the Torah, that you see there were animals who seem to be living thousands of years, millions of years, hundreds of millions of years before the way we date creation. So that disproves the Torah, and the Torah Yisrael, in one of his drushes, says that on the contrary, it actually proves something else that we find through Kabbalah, and it's mentioned in the Midrashim also, that there were many worlds that God created and destroyed before our world was created, and these may in fact be the remnants. So he said, Adrabah, on the contrary, this is really the greatest proof when we can find something which tells us that there was an existence of something otherwise we have no tangible recognition of. The Malbim and the Netziv both have a similar hypothesis, which basically tells us that the dinosaurs were destroyed with them, along with the mob, along with everybody else, and somehow they weren't taken onto the teva like some of the other animals. But they use that also along the same lines as pointing to the fact that the entire world had much stronger capabilities for sustaining life before the Mabul, and there was some sort of downgrade of the quality, again, of what type of life and what strength was sustainable after the Mabul happened. Okay, so now I want to use this as a long introduction, a parsha backdrop for the discussion of changes that extends far beyond the changes that occurred at the time of the flood, and actually has a lot more theoretical and even practical bearing on us in 2012. So we know not everything that's described in rabbinic literature in the realm of science, biology, zoology, medicine, geography is entirely consistent with the notions of the natural world that the empirical evidence, especially the last few hundred years, has yielded and the conclusions that the scientists have drawn from them. There are various approaches to dealing with the contradictions that seem to exist between the things we find in the Gemara and science in the world around us. Some things we'll touch upon, but the crux of what I wanted to look at tonight are instances in which the resolution to those discrepancies don't attempt some fancy footwork or a complex hypothesis to arrive at them, trying to fit them into our worldview, but rather where the answer to the question is, you're right, it's just different. It's just different. The notion known as Nishtana HaTeva, that perhaps in the same way that there was a change in the way that the physical world appeared before the Mabul, in much later generations, the last 2,000 years, there were also many changes in the way the physical world appears and functions that bring us a reality which does not necessarily reflect the reality described by Chazal. And again, with a number of rather practical ramifications. Of course, the Mabul was somewhat miraculous, so that's not the best paradigm, as I mentioned, although we do have other examples in Tanakh that seem to reflect major differences in our existence from not too long ago, again, in the scheme of things. Gemara Sanhedrin, for instance, tells us that there were a number of personalities in Tanakh who were seemingly able to bear children at the age of about 6 to 8, even 9, which doesn't really seem to fit in with our notions of biology. But again, whether those are the exceptions to the rule or not, the Gemara does discuss bringing those examples in Tanakh as perhaps paradigms in halacha. But we're going to fast forward to the time of the Rishon in medieval times, which is really the first time that we encounter an articulation of the notion of Nishtan HaTeva, where very real discrepancies were facing the Rishonim, and they were forced to answer to them. If you look at source number 4, the middle of that first line, the Gemara Moed Katan tells us as follows, Amar Rav, Amrli Ada Tzaida. Rav says that this fisherman, experienced fisherman by the name of Ada, told me as follows. Apparently he had expertise because he hung out with the fish all the time. Kavra Samach Lemisruche Miley. He said that it's a very good idea, if you have to choose when to eat fish, fish, as they begin to spoil, right before the point at which they are spoiled, is the best time to eat it. And in fact, it's actually very good, very healthy, and will have positive impact on an individual's health. So now, Tosfos on the spot says that that doesn't really fit into what we're used to, because we're usually quick to throw things out as soon as they, and fish especially, as it is, they don't smell all the time as delectable as other food. So, you know, as they move towards a sirachon, as they move towards rotting, we're definitely not going to hold on to them. So Tosa says, in the source immediately below that, Bizman hazet tofsim sakana lamechol samach l'sirachon. He says, if anything, our medicine, which, again, working in the medieval times, Tosa tells us, that if you eat the fish close to when it's going to spoil, it could actually be dangerous to you, just the opposite. Okay, and the only solution Tosfos can suggest, he says, Shema nishtanu kemo harufuah shebishas. Maybe in the same way we find lots of medical advice that the Chazal gave us that doesn't really seem to work in our notion of medicine. Perhaps that has changed, and this has also changed. And yeah, the fish are no longer healthy in the same way that they were. They're actually dangerous. He actually does have some other suggestions. He says, Oshem Anar is the Bavel Miley Lo Tfei. Maybe it depends on where the fish happened to grow. V'yesh Mefarshim Dekar V'lo B'chlal Dagemeyer. Maybe it's not all fish. Maybe it's specific species of fish. But either way, the Rishonim were already very much aware, and there are countless examples of this, that the science of their time did not match with the science of that of Chazal. So, once we have that precedent, so we can begin to talk about things that impact us, bizman hazeh. So moving along the same fish theme, so something we're a lot more familiar with because it seems to be something which is just about universally observed, at least to my knowledge. But you find this all across the board in religious communities that we're careful not to eat fish and meat together. That comes from a Gemara in Pesachim, Daf Ayin Vav, that's in the third column, so I number these by Hebrew letters, just to identify them. What is the source of that? Tani Rav Kahana, Bereder Rav Chinana, Saba, Pas She'afa Im Tzli B'taner, Asul Achla B'Kuscha. If you have bread baking in an oven, at the same time as meat is roasting in the same oven, so Asul Achla B'Kuscha, you're not allowed to eat that bread together with milchiks, because we assume that the aroma that comes from the meat affects the bread, and therefore the bread shouldn't be eaten with melchiks. Gemara goes further, another point. Hahi b'nisa d'idva b'hadi bisra asra, Rava miparzika l'mechel b'kuscha. The opinion of Rava miparzika was if you had fish and meat in the same oven, same time, then that fish also could not be eaten with milchiks in the same way the bread in the previous case can only be eaten with milchiks. Mar Bar Avashi goes even further. He says, if the fish was in the oven at the same time as the meat, the fish cannot be eaten, even if you just sprinkle some salt on top. Forget the milchiks. It cannot be eaten at all. Two reasons. Mishum the kashal reichot. Number one, gives you bad breath. Udavar acher. And some other anonymous problem that results. Someone who eats meat that is tainted by the fish. Or fish that's tainted by the meat, actually. Rashi in the next source says, "What's meaning of davar acher tzaras? Some sort of leprosy." I don't think it's referring to the tzaras that you know the more spiritual punishment that a person gets if they violate lashon hara, but some sort of physical ailment known as tzaras. So the third source is where we codify this in Shulchan Aruch. Gimel bein basal adagim chova lito mishum de kashel davar acher. The chamira sakanta meisur. It is required. The Shulchan Aruch tells us to wash your hands between meat and fish. We'll see in a second that's not our practice, but that's our first hint that there is a some separation has to be made between the fish and the meat. Why chamira sakanta misur? Because we may not understand 100%, but sakana, a danger, a possibility of a person inflicting some sort of ill health to them upon themselves is more strict than isur, than halachic prohibitions, and as a result, we have to be extra careful in avoiding taking such chances. The next source, You have to be careful not to eat milk and fish together, because it causes leprosy. Again, wash your hands in between, but the Ramah, the source of Ashkenazic practice, is really what you have to do is just make sure to eat something between the fish and the meat and drink something between the fish and the meat, and that will clean out your mouth sufficiently that you no longer have to be concerned about this. Many have the custom, based on the Chacham HaSadim, only to rinse out their mouth, only take a drink. Some have some schnapps. Either way, that's also certainly an acceptable practice. But the bottom line is there has to be some sort of distinction, some sort of separation between the two. Now the question is, if you encounter this line in the Gemara that says that there's a danger to eating fish and meat together, so it sounds a little bit strange because we're not familiar medically with anything that would be harmful. But at the same time, this is something which is so widely practiced. The poskim write about this minhag with such broad strokes that it's hard to understand why no one has ever questioned this over the years. Why is it so clear to us that that's how we should practice? On the contrary, it's fascinating to note in the next source, Hey, the Magen Avraham. The Magen Avraham, we have to bear in mind, is the primary classic and perhaps the most well-known commentary on the page in Shulchan Aruch. The Mishneh Berurah, which we're more familiar with because it's much more contemporary, it's written by the Chafetz Chaim, is 80%, something like that, taken directly from the Magen Avraham. And nevertheless, Magen Avraham says something fascinating on that very line in Shulchan Aruch. He says, after the Bezman Hazeh, ain't Sakana Kol Kach. He makes the point. He says, maybe nowadays the Sakana doesn't really exist so much. The Chazinim Kama Devarim HaMuskar MeGemara, Shem Sakana L'Ruach Ra. We find lots of things in the Gemara that are defined as dangerous in causing Ruach Ra, some sort of bad spirit, whatever that means. The Shar Devarim, the Ein Mazik. And nowadays we see that it doesn't hurt us. One thing that's mentioned in this context is if you put food under a bed, and someone sleeps on the bed, can that food be eaten? So the Gemara seems to say it's a bad idea, because of this Ruach Ra characteristic. But at the same time, again, we're not familiar with any impact that takes place that would make the food a bad idea to eat. So he says, he invokes that as an example. Shar Dvarim, V'ayidna Eino Mazik, V'nishana HaTivyos, maybe nature has changed in some significant way, to the extent that the nature being described by Chazal does not reflect, at least in this area, the nature that we, the reality that we live in. Vagama kolfi teva ratzos says maybe it also depends on where you happen to live. Different climates have different elements in the surroundings that affect people's health. So maybe that's also part of the discrepancy. And then he has a whole line and a half full of abbreviations, which point you to other places in Shulchan Aruch, maybe we'll get back to, that seem to back up his thesis. Yoredeish, Simen Shin Te Zayin, Evan Ezer, Simen Kuf Nun Vav. Maybe we will have a chance to look at that. It's important to note, just as an aside, I think this is more predominantly a Sephardi practice, but there are those who extend this requirement to separate between meat and fish to milchiks as well. Milchiks also not to be eaten directly together with the fish, not to be mixed together with the fish. Some say, if you look in the Ramah, quoted in Zion over there, he says, again representing Ashkenazi practice, Lo re'isi miyamayin nizharon b'zeh. I never saw anyone be concerned about this. Gam ba'orachayin, simen, kufayin, gimel, elsewhere in the source we read before, Shulchan Aruch himself makes no mention of the milchiks. The problem is eating the meat because of the sakana. Av b'chol of shari, milk together with meat is together with fish is permissible. And he ends off in the bolded line. A little play on words. He says the Beis Yosef who presents this prohibition of milk and fish together, milk and meat must have gotten mixed up for him. Okay, he must have mixed milk and meat together. In other words, he confused the two, suggesting that there really was no issue with the chalav altogether. And again, common practice, certainly amongst Ashkenazim, is not to be concerned about this. Okay, so why is it in fact that the Magen Avraham's approach wasn't really accepted if, again, he's making a pretty logical, pretty reasonable suggestion? So the answer seems to be that when it comes to matters of sakana, when it comes to issues of danger, and apparently tzaras, the leprosy, is relevant to that. So as the Shulchan Aruch mentioned before, chamira sakanta mi isura. danger is taken more seriously, in a certain sense, than isser, than prohibitions, halachic problems. Where, when it comes to isurim, so we're familiar with the concept that that you go basarov, you follow the majority. In general, the halachic mandate of dine Torah is that we go based on the majority cases to determine what's dangerous. I'm sorry, what is permitted, what's not permitted, and strictly speaking, you know, the classic example that the Rishonim talk about is if you have two pieces of kosher meat, one piece of non-kosher meat, and they get mixed up in a bowl, and you don't know which one is which, so there are two pieces of kosher meat, so the majority wins, and as a result, you follow the heter, and all of them are permissible. There are some caveats, could be we're not allowed to eat all three of the pieces together, but bottom line, the concept of bittel, the concept of following the row, following the majority, generally applies. There are some exceptions to that. Sometimes Chazal came and went a step further. A classic example of this is when it comes to checking bugs that are found in vegetables. So you might say that if I go into the supermarket and there's heads of broccoli there. So broccoli is something which is very prone to insect infection. So if there's 100 pieces of broccoli, 100 florets of broccoli on display, and you checked the majority of them, you may find in fact that 60 or 70 out of the 100 have no bugs inside. Okay, just giving an example. So you might say that the majority wins, so I can look at the other 40, that I don't see any bugs there, and I can assume that if the majority, generally speaking, more than 50% of broccoli florets from this crop don't have bugs, so I can assume that everything from that crop is permissible because you follow the rope. So there, sometimes Chazal came along and said, no, we have something called a miut hamatsui, a significant and commonly occurring minority that has to be taken seriously. And that can be as low as 10 to 15%. So if 10 to 15% of the broccoli, in fact, is infested, then I have to be concerned, even if the majority is not infested. Okay, but that's but the bottom line is that line, chamira sakanta miyisura, that danger is more of a concern than isurim, tells us that even the rules that apply when it comes to isurim, whether it be 50% or 10% or 15%, aren't sufficient when it comes to danger. If a person is, God forbid, very ill, and the question is whether or not he should violate Shabbos, go to the hospital, if he should eat on Yom Kippur to preserve his health. So you don't say, well, 51% of people with this condition live through it, and therefore you don't have to, therefore don't break your fast, don't go to the hospital on Shabbos, because the majority of people make it. Yeah, but 49% don't. When it comes to life-threatening situation, even if there's a very, very small chance that a person's life is at stake, nevertheless, that is enough to allow us to violate halacha, to violate Shabbos, Yom Kippur, whatever it happens to be, because the sakana is more of a concern to us than the general line of thinking when it comes to isurim. So therefore, it could be that even though we find that what Chazal told us to stay away from the fish and the meat, it's true, we don't see that in the overwhelming majority of cases nowadays. But it seems that the custom became that we have to take the recommendations of Chazal seriously to some extent. And even if, again, the overwhelming majority of situations, no one will be negatively affected by the fish and the meat, we have to be careful nonetheless, because when it comes to life-threatening situations, when it comes to danger, person's health, even if there's a much smaller chance of danger, we still have to take that into account. Hold on one second. So that's why we don't have an all-out, wholesale disregard of what the Magen Avraham is telling us. But of what the Gemara tells us. But the Magen Avraham did not fall off the map altogether. I just want to make a mention of this because, again, very practical. I'll get to that in a second. What happens? Okay, let's say you have we're assuming, as is common practice, that the fish and the meat should be separated. A person's supposed to have something to drink at the very least in between the two. Let's say I'm cooking a big pot of meatballs, and we know that if by accident someone would pour a drop of milk into that pot of meatballs, so as long as there's less than a ratio of 1 to 60, okay, the meaning the ratio is greater, the meatballs to the milk, so then that's the context of bittel, nullification, because we assume that when the ratio is that high, greater than 60, there is no recognizable remnant, nothing that you could taste to recognize the fact that milk fell into that pot. So what if a little bit of fish fell into that pot of meatballs? So should we say as well that as long as the ratio is greater than 60 and up, then that's sufficient to permit this, which is, you know, essentially a combination of milk and, of meat and fish, which we're supposed to be avoiding. So that is a very significant machlokas, haposkim, whether or not sakana, dangerous things, are batal, whether or not they have the status of nullification in Shishim in 60. Now, the case against assuming that the fish becomes nullified is this same principle of chamira sakanta miyisura, that even if iser can be nullified in 60, maybe that doesn't give us the right to assume that something that's dangerous should also be nullified with the same proportions, or maybe it should never be nullified whatsoever, because it's just a whole different realm of discussion, and we don't have a right to transpose the rules from one to the other. But the truth is that most poskim seem to assume that we can follow those authorities who hold that if the fish, again, anything which poses some sort of dangerous concern, falls into the mixture where its presence is less than a 60th, it's permissible. It's permissible. And the rationale is that, in the end of the day, the Magen Avraham really does make the most sense. Really does make the most sense that we have no way of putting our finger on any danger in the mixture nowadays. It's hard for us to make a wholesale disregard of what the Gemara tells us, but when there are other elements that that are brought into question, other tzadim l'kula, any reasons for leniency, we'll take advantage of them. And this is one of them. Again, siding with those who say that as long as there is a shear of bittel of nullification, it's sufficient, and the meatballs become permissible. Another factor, I'll get back to you in a second, David. I'm sorry. Another factor is along the similar lines is what's known as a svek sveka in halacha. So you know, we have ways of dealing with doubtful situations. A suffik d'oraisa, if I'm not sure whether there's a violation of a Torah law, suffik d'oraisa l'chumra, I have to be careful, I have to be machmir, I have to be stringent. When it comes to a d'rabbanan, when it comes to rabbinic law, suffik d'rabbanan l'kula. Okay, so I'm allowed to be lenient when I'm not sure, I'm not positive that there's actually a rabbinic prohibition in place over here. Now, what if we have a double doubt, a svek sveka, in this situation means that on one hand, the Magen Avraham, we'll do it like this. I'm not sure if it's appropriate to say that the fish is nullified in 60, because after all, as we said before, it's a sakana, maybe it's more strict. So on the one hand, some people say that it is permissible when it falls in 60. But maybe we'll assume that it's not permissible even when it falls into 60. Okay, but even if we're not sure about that, even if you do assume that when something dangerous falls into 60, it's not nullified, but there's another disagreement, namely, we also have the opinion of the Magen Avraham as a backup to rely on, that even if, in fact, you can't nullify the dangerous item in 60, but we can also then take into account, as a svek sveka, as a secondary doubt, that perhaps the danger of the fish and the meat does not exist altogether. Okay, what is the practical relevance of this? So I think this is fascinating. If you turn to page 2. Okay, David, as soon as we finish this subject, I will get to you. So what you have on the left side is a scan of a, I don't know, I don't want to call it top secret because it's definitely not classified anymore, but the OU, because they deal with all kinds of shilas every single day, complicated shilas, and you know, the OU has been around for many decades, so different policy decisions that come up along the way are recorded and archived so that if similar questions come up in the future, the OU has record of what decisions were made by the halachic decision makers at the OU so that they can be applied in the future. So here's a question in F41. Okay, so Worcester sauce, which is known for, number one, its function as a steak sauce, okay? But on the other hand, is also known to have an important ingredient, namely anchovies, okay? So as if you can read it there, the Shayla, what was the question? Ha'im mutter lahanik hechsher le-Worcester sauce, okay? Is it appropriate for the OU to provide a hechsher, to authorize a hechsher, to put an OU stamp on the package of Worcester sauce, sheyesh bo ma'at tam dag, that has a little bit of taste of fish in it, el shu bevadai batel besamach, okay, this is a key line, it is certainly batel, it is certainly present in a proportion less than 60, u'meshtam shem besoas hazeh b'chtei lahatem basar b'shas b'shula, and this sauce, of course, is used for fleshic dishes with meat inside. So is it appropriate, in other words, to rely on the assumption that it'll be batel, it'll be nullified in Shishim, because obviously if you put the OU on it, people are going to go and pour it in their meat recipes. So the first answer, as you can see, is given by Rav Schachter, where he basically takes the approach that, similar to what we just detailed, that there's a combination of different poskim over here. If you look, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines from the end of that paragraph after the period. Alkein bevada mutu lahanek hechsher l'sos shekazeh. It's certainly permissible to give a hechsher to the sauce. Shetam hadag shebo kfar nizbatel basamuk. Because it's certainly batel in shishim. Afilim nitfas al petek sha'al habak bukshu hu steak sauce. Even if it says in big letters that this is a steak sauce, which is obviously, you know, along with the OU, the kashras were also saying, you know, enjoy it at your barbecue. Memela muvan shirov akonim yarbo also bebasser, and that's what's assumed you're going to do with it. Yeshutzar dasa magnarum dasa iser vehetter v'chanal. You can combine the opinions we mentioned before, and it's permissible. The imen atzorach lahad bistachas several ha'OU sheish bodam. This is the key. You don't have to write under the OU fish, as you do find on packages sometimes. The elu hakonim shirotzim lahachmir v'zeh, those who want to be machmir, and let's say they want to follow the opinion that says that we don't assume that sakana is batel b'shishim. Shalol l'shamis b'sos hazel l'bishol basar, yuchol l'ayim b'rshimas hamachilam sh'al ha'petek, v'likro sh'yesh bo anchovies b'sulo midi. Shachter says, let's say you have someone out there who's machmir on this question. So the OU has to take responsibility to some extent for him also. So okay, but it still says anchovies in the on the ingredients list. And as a result, it's not misleading if the OU just writes OU and doesn't say fish. In fact, if they do write OU fish, so then the OU gets thousands of phone calls. You know, what does this mean? It's a steak sauce and it says fish on it. If you don't put the fish there, then people don't question anything. Rabbi Belsky, in the next paragraph, adds an important ha'ara, important observation. He says, I agree 100% to what to Rav Schachter's decision that we read a moment ago. If there's more than 1 in 60, so then it is certainly appropriate to write OU fish, because then it's actually present in a proportion where you could really be you really have a halachic problem or a sakana problem, as we explained. However, I'm sorry, it's less than 60, you can just leave it in the ingredients if there's less than a 60. There was a certain story that came to my attention. You really have to be very careful to see how exactly it's listed in the ingredient panel. Why? Omega-3 oils. Sometimes the fish is present and it's listed amongst the other ingredients, but in a way that if you're not thinking about it, you're not going to notice. There has to at least be an explicit mention of the fact that there is fish present in the sauce, or the name of the fish, right, that is anchovies, and as a result, it will be clear to the consumer what exactly we're dealing with. Okay, I'll stop for a moment, and before we wrap up this topic, which the fish and the meat looks like that's all we'll get to tonight, David, I'm sorry if I held you off for so long.
I'm just wondering, the assumption seems to be that we're at least in doubt as to whether we need to be, whether this is still a health issue, but it could be. I think I'm right that there are other cases of, there are other instances of things that the Gemara says are dangerous, mm-hmm. where we now do them and we don't even hesitate.
Right.
We
never
doubt about it.
Right.
So I can't supply examples, but
how do we make the choice?
When it still might be a problem, when it's definitely not a problem.
That's an excellent question. I think one answer that the poskim suggests, which is it's just interesting in the way that it comes about, we have a concept in the Gemara known as Dashu Bei Rabim, common practice, which is based on a pasuk in Tehillim, Shomer Pesoyim Hashem, which literally means God protects the simple folk. Okay, so now that what that means exactly, it's been applied in a whole range of scenarios. Perhaps the most famous or infamous, I don't mean that the full connotation of the way the word is usually used, but Rav Moshe Feinstein in a tshuva written decades ago about the permissibility of smoking mentions Shomer Pesachim Hashem. He says it's so commonly found amongst people all over the place that they smoke regularly. And it must be, if it's so commonly accepted and people don't view it as a dangerous behavior to engage in, so there's no reason for us to therefore assume that there's some inherent danger. Whatever is the standard practice of risk-taking for people, commonly accepted, that is the risk that one is allowed to take. Now, obviously, had he been aware of the Surgeon General warnings, all the data we know today, so he wouldn't consider that Shomer Pesachim Hashem, because all those people who, when he wrote the Tshuva, I think in the 60s, were, smoking, are, unfortunately, if they're still alive, they're suffering terribly, unfortunately. We are able to extrapolate to many other areas. A person wants you want to be the next skydiver to, break another record, okay? You're gonna skydive from Mars, okay? So now, one has to ask himself, is that the normal type of risk that your average person takes? It is normal to go outside and cross the street. It is normal to, go on a roller coaster, and that has some dangers, but it's also normal for people to do it. So what the bar at which we will sometimes delineate where it's permissible for a person to take risks and where it's not is often guided by what common practice is. That said, getting back to your question, David, so Possum point to the fact that we have no record in the last 2,000 years since this Gemara was published, okay, figuratively, that there was a significant community in Klal Yisrael where this law was not observed, okay? And if that's the case, as opposed to other other things we find in Chazal, which, like you said, they sort of have fallen out of common practice, so the distinction is that we can only use the bar that we described before, Shomer Pesachim Hashem, when we have concrete evidence over some extended period of time that it fell by the wayside. So the Magen Avraham's suggestion is great, but we don't have, our control group and our experimental group in order to prove that, and no one really wants to be the first one to take a chance, okay? But that I think, is the way the Poskim addressed your question. Okay, just to wrap this up, last couple of minutes, I wanted to read you one or two other points that the Poskim mentioned on this subject. Let's get back to the fish for a second. Maybe we'll save that for next week. So this was step one, this chup was written, I think, in the mid-90s. Is that correct? Yeah, 1993 was Rav Schechter's original psak, and it's very interesting. When did Rabbi Belsky add on his observation about the omega-3? In 2005, Tavshin Samachay. Okay, because I imagine, and maybe you can tell me better, who was taking omega-3 in 1993? Who, that wasn't the hot, was it a...
Today, the big omega-3 is the Lovazo, which you see advertised on TV, and they say, if you're allergic to fish...
Yeah. Stay away. Right. Okay, but I'm saying it's much more of a... it's more on people's minds. Yeah, it's much more in vogue now than it was 20 years ago. So Rabbi Belsky was astute in, picking up on the... Okay. The health trends. Yes, thank you. Okay. All right. Now, the postscript to this is that there's another halacha that we find in the Yoredeya, that even though normally we assume that, again, 60 is our measure for when something will become nullified, when it's going to become batal, there are a couple exceptions to the rule. Notably, is what Chazal referred to as a milsa da'avida l'taima, an item, an ingredient which is designed, which its whole purpose is to add taste. Okay, let's say salt. Okay, spices, just salt. Okay, let's say you had salt that for some reason was prohibited. Generally, salt doesn't really need a hefsher, but in theory we could come up with situations where the salt was actually prohibited. So if it fell into chicken soup, now you don't put too much salt, relative to the volume of the chicken soup in the pot, but nevertheless, even if there was much more than 60 times the salt, since the salt still can have recognizable potency and taste, again, beyond that sheer of 60, the chicken soup is nevertheless usher. Okay, so Rabbi Luban, also one of the chief rabbis, so to speak, at the OU, made the observation that the anchovies in the Worcester sauce would seem to be a milsa d'avida l'taima. You put it in; it's one of the ingredients. It's there, to be noticeable, give the flavor that it's meant to give in the steak sauce. And you buy Worcester sauce, and instead of buying barbecue sauce or steak sauce or of other types, because you want that flavor that the Worcester sauce adds. So if that's the case, so everything we our heter was based upon before falls by the wayside, because the shear of 60, which is part of the underlying permissibility of the steak sauce to be mixed with the steak, is no longer operable. So what do you do? So F42 ends like that. Okay, the next document, you don't have it there, but the next document ends with that question. So I was left this document. I didn't know what to do with it. I called the OU. Had a friend who was working there at the time a couple of years ago, and asked him to please research, what's the end of the story, because I was still seeing the Worcester sauce in the supermarket with the OU. So he said they called Heinz, okay, where, that's who they give the Hechsher to, and they asked the people there a little bit about the product, and eventually they asked him about the anchovy presence. They asked him exactly how much is there, and basically what their answer was, you can't taste the anchovies. But we wouldn't be able to sell the Worcester sauce, because what self-respecting chef would put Worcester sauce in his steak that doesn't have any anchovies in it? So all they do is they put a little bit in to be yotze, to whatever the FDA, minimum to reflect on the ingredient panel would require, okay? And with that, they're yotze. So the whole thing is a joke, okay? When you think you're buying your fishy Worcester sauce, there's a lot of other things that are fishy about it. The bottom line is, when the OU is giving that Hechsher, so they really have no concern. They don't even have this Milsa Vidal Taima concern. By the way, I think the I don't know if this is the a proof, but the firm brands, Manischewitz, Geffen, those companies, when they also have a line of Worcester sauce, and there's no fish in them. So someone's getting by without putting too much anchovies in it regardless, and Heinz picked up on that too, and as a result there were no halachic questions involved. Okay, so that's one example of how, a very practical example of how Mishtana HaTeva impacts our own behavior, and perhaps next week we'll talk about some other interesting cases of Mirtz Hashem.